This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
Checkpoint Intimates. Welcome to the very first episode of Checkpoint Intimates, here with Luke and Elliot today.
Yeah.
Talking about our first topic for this sort of, I guess you'd say, sub-podcast, sort of a bit of extra content for you guys.
Sure, we can call it a sub-podcast.
Yeah, Checkpoint Intimates. And today, because we've both recently finished the really, really good horror game, Resident Evil 7 Biohazard, which it came out about a week and a half ago now. We've both now had a chance to finish the game. So I reviewed it on the show last week, but, you know, there's so much to talk about with the franchise and with horror games generally. We thought we'd take some time to properly dissect, which is an appropriate word if you've played the game, Resident Evil 7. So now, Elliot, how does it compare to the older Resident Evils, the classic ones that we're used to playing?
Yeah, are we talking like 1, 2, 3, the original trilogy?
Yeah, I think they're the ones that people kind of tend to go back to and think about and sort of, you know.
There's definitely an aspect of revisiting some of those ideas raised in Resident Evil, the original trilogy. Yeah, and just like some of the horror aspects and like the puzzles are just, some of them are straight out of the original games.
Yeah.
Which is really crazy because you see all the footage for Resident Evil 7 and you say, oh, this is totally new. There was a lot of discussion before about, is this even a Resident Evil game?
Yeah.
It is. It definitely, well, I thought it was.
Yeah, and you sort of, you don't realize until you play it how much of a Resident Evil game it is. So, I mean, you're right, the puzzles are a big part of that, but also the inventory and how you have to manage that. You know, you have a limited amount of space in your backpack to the point where quite early on you're finding herbs and things that you know you're going to need later to get better and to heal yourself, but you literally don't have space because you have ammunition instead, or you might have a piece of a puzzle that you need to hang on to, even though you might not know when that puzzle's coming up, but you just feel like you have to carry it with you anyway. So quite quickly, that anxiety and that stress of having this limited capacity to carry things comes through, which the old games were really famous for.
Yeah, exactly. And like, I can see frustration for the whole inventory management thing, but what it forces people to do is backtrack and go back to like these areas where you can drop your stuff off. And that actually provides some really good opportunities for scare moments, because the time you're most vulnerable is when you think nothing's going to happen. And you never think something's going to happen once you've backtracked and walked back through the same room you were just in.
Yeah. And then, of course, you're wrong sometimes.
Yeah. Well, yeah, they love throwing something at you when you least expect it.
I tell you what, well, I saw an achievement or a trophy either way, depending on how you're placed, but where you can do the whole game. And if you can do the entire game by only using that box of supplies to get all your stuff back and change it around, if you use that less than 3 times in the entire game, you get an achievement.
I saw that and was like, oh my,
I couldn't imagine that.
That seems like a puzzle in itself to try to achieve that, because you need, like, ammo is scarce. You need weaponry, you need ammo, you need health. Like, I'm always really cautious when I play these games, super slow, methodical, like, but I still needed health constantly.
Yeah.
So
yeah, it's like that. And I mean, talking about, you know, how it works as a horror game, because I think it definitely takes a lot of beats from modern horror in how it's done. I mean, arguably, P.T., the playable teaser for Silent Hills, which of course never eventuated, that was released at E3 a couple of years ago.
I feel like there's direct inspiration from that.
Yeah, I mean, walking down those corridors, it's reminiscent of that exactly. But even just that photorealistic style they've gone for within the game, at times it looks like you're walking around an actually motion-captured world because it looks so beautiful and so realistic.
It does. I played it on the PC, so I'm not actually sure if they've amped up the graphics for the PC, but I thought it was beautiful. And it was one of the first games that have started to make my computer struggle. I had to tone down, I think, the anti-aliasing or something like that just a little bit, just to make sure the frame rate stayed consistent. And I was like, oh damn, I'm gonna have to upgrade my PC again.
You're a PC gamer, so you have a good PC already, I'm assuming.
Yeah, no, it was great. And I haven't had a problem with it for, like, I think I've had a year and a half now. And I've been able to run everything highest graphic settings. So it was kind of cool to have something in that, like, tested it, finally.
Pushed it over the line. Yeah. Made it cry. I love that. But just the way that it's, especially the first half of the game. So, I mean, the back half of the game, it does tend to head down towards a bit more of an action-oriented path.
Yeah, I'll can I straight up say, I think one of my... I love Resident Evil 7. One of my biggest criticisms would be that the kind of back end, the last third of the game wasn't scary for me, like, at all, and it had lost it. I think it did it deliberately. It moved it in a more action-oriented direction, but that kind of... It ended up sacrificing some of the horror elements.
Yeah, I think that that's one of the issues with horror as a genre generally, and that goes for film as well as video games. Once you know what that bump in the dark is and you know what that thing is, it becomes less scary. So you're hyper-aware of what it's going to be. So the lack of enemy variety in the game overall means that by the third or fourth act, you sort of already know all there is to know about the enemies and what they look like and how they're going to fight you. So when they come up, you don't get that jolt scare anymore. You're just kind of like going through the motions to finish the game.
Yeah, it was definitely like that for the Ouroboros. Is that the correct term, or is that like old Resident Evil term that I'm just pushing back here?
No, I know what you mean. You mean those creepy, like, gross things?
I'm talking, yeah, the main enemy that constantly reoccurs throughout the game.
Yeah,
definitely. Like, maybe the first few times you see it, it's like tense, but you learn that you can deal with these things.
Yeah.
Which is a shame because of like the whole enemy variety you brought up, that they really do keep reoccurring. I mean, different iterations of the same monster, but it is the same monster.
Even different versions of the same boss. You know, there's, you know, almost comically, the first major boss that you encounter in the game ends up coming back about 5 times.
Yeah, I actually really like that, though. I'm not going to use that as a criticism because I love the characters they've created, and so re-seeing that over and over again in different forms, I kind of appreciate it.
I got to a point with it where I was like, can you just die already? Like, I'm not... You're not scary now. You're just kind of annoying.
And well,
I kind of
thing. At that, like, point. Every time you kill something, you're like, God, I hope that was the last time. Like, please don't come back. Yeah. But, like, I felt like that because I didn't want to deal with the character due to fear. And that's a really good feeling.
That's true. I think that that's sort of... that hypens back to Nemesis in Resident Evil 3, where you have this boss who you end up, it's stalking you through the entire game, and even when you kill it or you think you've defeated it, it's going to come back. You know, you're going to leave the room and then you're going to reappear in the room later, and that body's not going to be there, which means he's probably out stalking you
again. And how
often
did that happen in this game?
Yeah, too often for me, but I understand what it's harkening back to.
But it felt so Resident Evil, didn't it? Like, there was something about it that like really captured the spirit of those original games, which was cool. But definitely, like, as we were talking before, like, it had the whole PT thing going on for it, but then it kind of changed things up again and it became a more action-oriented game.
Yeah.
It kind of went through all stages of horror that we're used to. Like, it took inspiration from PT, it took inspiration from, like the Amnesia style of scares where something's chasing you and you have to hide and...
Yeah.
And then, like, at the end, it was, like, all, like, I guess Resident Evil or Dead Spacey or something, where a lot of the scares with the monsters are popping up, but you've got the weaponry to deal with it.
Well, it even was Dead Space-like in the sense that you could actually lob off limbs of these creatures to affect how they'd attack you. So if you take their legs out, they then start crawling towards you and leaping off the ground. So that was very Dead Space. They didn't really explain that or make it a point like Dead Space did, where it was like literally like tips in the menu of how to take down foes, but they definitely had that effect to them, these kind of creatures that could still keep coming at you unless you destroy the head.
Yeah.
That's the only way you can deal with them, which is classic zombie and classic Resident Evil as well.
But it did it well. Like, like the hitboxes on the enemies and like they would get wounds in spots that I didn't expect it, and they just like obviously had a lot of hit markers that tore off limbs or chucked holes through their torsos and stuff that was really, really cool.
One of the main criticisms of the game that I keep seeing is that the puzzles were pretty easy. They weren't super challenging. And, you know, in the old Resident Evil games, some of the puzzles were, like, ridiculous. Like, so hard where you'd have to literally look up a game guide in the back of a magazine, because this was the 90s, to try and figure out how to solve it. Whilst in Resident Evil 7, I mean, most of the puzzles were kind of simple. Like, you know, you got to grab an object and spin it until it matches a shadow. Or there was one where you had to, like, change the time of a clock.
Yeah, can I stop you real quick?
Yes.
Those spinning the shadow puzzles were the hardest thing ever using a mouse. They were so obnoxious to control with the mouse because it doesn't have the directional movements of like a joystick in the same way.
PC and fail.
It was like the one instance where I'm like, oh, this is, why am I playing with a mouse? I mean, the whole other time I was like, yes, I'm shooting, I want a mouse, but those puzzles were a nightmare. But they weren't challenging because they were like difficult to comprehend. They were challenging because of like an input issue. So.
Yeah. I mean, I found them pretty simple, especially when you're revisiting similar ones time and time again. I think that, you know, they try to make it almost a bit too easy because they were focusing so much on the atmosphere and so much on the feeling of the game where it didn't really matter what the puzzles and the locks were. Like, as soon as you got a certain key with a crow on it, you knew that was for the door with the big crow on it. Like, it was...
Yeah.
It was fairly simple to put those pieces together and relatively linear in how you acquire those pieces as well. There wasn't a lot of unknown backtracking for me or a lot of like not knowing where to go. It seemed to me, based on the rooms that I hadn't been to yet on my mini map or on the map itself, that I could pretty clearly figure out where to go next and what to do. So I think that that made it a bit less scary in that sense, because you sort of had an idea of where you were going each time. It wasn't that kind of feeling of helplessness that other games in the franchise have had where you genuinely don't know what to do next.
I agree, and I think that's a bit of a... It's a shame, and it keeps reoccurring in AAA games because they have such a broad audience, and everyone... Like, the developers want everyone to be able to take part, so, yeah, you do tend to see these puzzles that are easier and stuff like that. There was, at one point, you were looking for three dog heads, and I had, like... I'd found all three, and then I came across a note that literally pointed out where they were. I'm like, do people really need this? Like, it just, there were points where, and even story beats where I had figured it out already, and then they just, there was no subtlety to it. They just explained it, and I'm like, oh, yeah, well, right.
Yeah, do you think that's partly an issue with people that want to digest games in a very quick kind of way where, yeah, we're all time poor. We work and we study and we have all these things. We have relationships. We have lives, damn it. And, you know, sometimes people don't have tens of hours to backtrack and to figure things out for themselves. And that's a big flaw with games, I find, like your Dark Souls and stuff like that, because they are so big and there's so many possibilities. You don't quite know if you're on the right path until you kind of get there and there's bosses you don't even have to encounter and stuff like that. And for someone like me who's really time poor, I want to sit down and play for 2 hours and know that I'm going to progress in that time period. So I feel like maybe they designed it in a way that it was easy to digest. And that's why the adventure only takes around 8 hours or so to complete. I mean, that was my playtime.
I think I hit the 10-hour mark, but I was probably being super thorough.
Super cautious as well, every corner.
Well, yeah, I mean, I kind of wanted to be. Like, I'd like to throw myself in the horror. And to do that, you kind of have to be slow and methodical and get scared. Which is a weird thing to say, because I know a lot of people probably are trying to avoid scares, but I want to be scared. I want to be in there.
That's why you play horror. Yeah. I think people that don't want to get scared play horror games at all. Surely those of us who like horror, we're the main market here.
And those are the people you force to play for your own entertainment.
Yes.
Which I've already done.
Yeah, me too. And speaking of forced to play for your entertainment, I mean, really cool to see a fully fledged retail release entirely functional with VR.
Yeah.
On PlayStation VR at the moment, but I think it's coming to Oculus and that later, I think, is the plan.
They
right?
did mention that, but I mean, there's no, like, solidified anything.
But it should, and I think it's the... I don't know if it's the best way to play it, but it definitely changes it enough that it's worth playing again in VR or setting up your friends to play it in VR.
I'd definitely go another run through if I had access to, like, VR, definitely, because that would be an experience all to itself.
Yeah, I mean, like I said it on the show, but there's something really, really creepy about hearing a noise and having to physically turn your body to see what that noise is. And, you know, it's sort of, I didn't realize as a horror fan how scary it was in VR until I played it. Like, I was getting anxiety in a fun kind of way, because I did want to play it, but I was getting anxiety about putting the headset on. I was like, oh no, am I really doing this? Like, am I actually going back into this world where I can't see anything around me, but this horrible, creepy house and these enemies popping up and demons and things. It really made it an extra level of tension that I wasn't expecting.
Yeah. Yeah, I can totally see that. I actually got a bit of anxiety every time I got a new tape, because I was always like, okay, I know what the house has to offer. I've explored these areas. Like, something might change slightly, but I'm fairly confident. And then you get a tape and I'm like, well, where is this going to take me to? Like, what am I living at now? And that was, I thought that was a really cool mechanic.
It was clever. I would like to see more, and they're going to have more tapes as DLC down the track, I'm pretty sure as well.
That sounds good to me.
Yeah, me too. Because, I mean, it's nice to have backstory and to build this kind of puzzle of what happened in this house and what happened to this family and to these people. And not only was it like, it wasn't just a cutscene though, like it would be in most games, games, you're actually physically playing it. You're in the first person, you're playing the role of a cameraman or of somebody else, which I won't spoil, and essentially you're living that moment, and you can die in that moment as well. Mm. And not only that, but because these tapes are set in the past, of course, the things that you do in those tapes affects the world that you're in now. So if you use an item to unlock something in the past, if you come across that same drawer or whatever in the future, in the present, you can't unlock that. It's already open because it was open in the past.
Yeah.
So you have to be careful about what you use, and do you need to use it in the tapes, or should you leave it because you know you might encounter that later and might need that ammo at a more pivotal moment. So I thought that was really clever as well.
Yeah, it's an interesting dynamic. I kind of wish they used that a bit more frequently. Maybe I kind of missed that. I saw that in the demo and that the original tape, but then since then, like, the third tape had a really interesting moment where you learnt things that you then used when you came across them later.
Yeah.
I didn't see that much instance of, like, the past affecting the future.
The second tape had more of that.
Okay.
Yeah. The second tape had moments where literally I came across something I'd found in the tape and it was already used, so I couldn't use it again
in my current playthrough. See, I missed that.
Yeah, so I think, I mean, maybe you just didn't have a need for it when you played the tape like I did. You know, maybe in the tape I encountered an enemy where I was like, well, I need this, whilst you didn't have that issue. So... which is interesting as well. So, look, overall, I think that Resident Evil 7 Biohazard, it's a faithful Resident Evil game. It does all the right things that Resident Evil games want to do, but also it modernized it so well at the same time.
Yeah, it's definitely its own thing. Like, and I'm so glad they didn't go Resident Evil 7 that's, like, very similar to 6 and 5 and 4, because that started to run really, really thin by the 6th game. So they went for a new direction and it paid off. And I'm glad they did it. Most certainly, yeah.
Yeah. Thanks, guys, very much for joining us on our first episode of Checkpoint Intimates.
Intimates.
You can expect this podcast once a week for you, going a bit deeper into a certain topic. Elliot, thank you very much.
Thank you, Luke.
This has been Luke for Checkpoint on Joy 94.9.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast, brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Help us keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.